What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. In Syria, suspected rebel rocket struck a hospital Tuesday in the contested northern city Aleppo, leaving at least 19 dead. The 12-day death toll in the city is about 280. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said diplomatic efforts are trying to extend a partial cessation of hostilities to Aleppo.
And we are particularly aiming to try to restore this in Aleppo, Syria's largest city, where the violence has increased so significantly and is in danger, without a cessation reinstituted, in danger of spiraling out of control.
Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov met in Moscow Tuesday with UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura, indicating a truce might be in place within hours. Kerry also repeated his view that President Bashar al-Assad has no political future in the country.
If Assad's strategy is to somehow think he's going to just carve out Aleppo and carve out a section of the country, I got news for you and for him. This war doesn't end. It is simply physically impossible for Assad to just carve out an area and pretend that he's somehow going to make it safe while the underlying issues are unresolved in this war. And as long as Assad is there, the opposition is not going to stop fighting him.
U.S. diplomat also set a deadline for a political transition in Syria by August 1st. Kenyan police say they disrupted an alleged extremist cell of medics linked to the Islamic State, believed to have plotted a biological attack on Kenya. The group is also accused of trying to recruit university students to join the IS in Syria and Libya. This is VOA News. A U.S. Navy SEAL Special Forces member was killed Tuesday by Islamic State fighters as he was advising Kurdish Peshmerga fighters in northern Iraq. Josh Earnest is a White House spokesman.
Initial reports are that this service member died when ISIL terrorists penetrated a checkpoint that was manned by Iraqi forces. Those terrorists, after breaking through the line, went on to attack a Peshmerga position where this U.S. service member was advising our partners on the ground. U.S. forces responded right away with air power to stop the attack, and our Iraqi partners are engaging the remnants of those forces.
This is the third American service member to have been killed in Iraq this year. In U.S. politics, New York businessman Donald Trump is now virtually assured of the Republican Party's presidential nomination, having secured victory Tuesday in the Indiana state primary election and a decision by his chief rival, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, to end his campaign.
We have to win again. We have to know how to win. And we haven't won. We've been losing all the time. We lose with our military. We can't beat ISIS. We lose with trade. We lose with borders. We lose with everything. We're not going to lose. We're going to start winning again, and we're going to win big league collegiate.
Trump speaking to his supporters, Cruz told his supporters he had no viable way forward to the nomination.
We left it all on the field in Indiana. We gave it everything we've got. But the voters chose another path. And so, with a heavy heart, but with boundless optimism for the long-term future of our nation, we are suspending our campaign.
On the Democratic side, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton lost the Indiana primary to her lone rival, Vermont Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders, but is still almost certain to be her party's presidential nominee. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Tom Malinowski Tuesday marked World Press Freedom Day by noting that 70 journalists were killed last year, with hundreds more in prison for doing their jobs. Malinowski said journalists were often most vulnerable to unlawful detentions and other human rights abuses in countries where there are crises or in conflict. He cited Syria, Yemen, Burundi, Turkey, and Libya as examples. Israel says its troops shot and killed a Palestinian driver in the occupied West Bank after he rammed his vehicle into one carrying three Israeli soldiers. An Israeli court handed down a life prison term to the accused ringleader of an Israeli gang that kidnapped and burned to death a Palestinian teenager 2 years ago. Two other Israelis have already been convicted in the death of Mohammed Abu Ghader, one with a defendant receiving a life prison term, the other 21 years. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today's Wednesday, May 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Comorians will vote on May 11th in a partial rerun of their April 10th presidential election.
Well, people are ready. The question is of the logistics. On the other hand, the contenders, none of them has raised questions about logistics. They only raised questions about how to secure the votes, you know, transparency.
Mohamed Nchagama is president of the Consumer Society of the Comoros Islands. Sailors pay a heavy price as pirates shift tactics in West Africa, and freedom of information is under threat as the world observed World Press Freedom Day yesterday, Tuesday.
Where press freedom is denied, you're much more likely to see conflict and war. We're much more likely to see corruption. We're much more likely to see collapses in good governance.
That's U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Tom Malinowski. South Sudan journalists face challenges in doing their job. We'll talk to the niece of an Eritrean journalist who has been detained in Comunicado for the last 14 years. Forced anal testing to prove homosexuality goes before a Kenyan court, and new urine test offers quick, painless check for malaria. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Comorians will vote on May 11th in a partial rerun of their April 10 presidential election. The country's constitutional court ordered the rerun in 13 constituencies over the weekend because of widespread irregularities in the April 2nd round voting. Partial results of that poll gave victory to former coup leader Azali Assoumani with about 41% of the vote, while Comorian Vice President Mohamed Ali Soule got about 40%. The May 11th rerun date on the island of Anjouan was announced in a presidential decree. Mohamed Nchagama, president of the Consumer Society of the Comoros Islands, says the rerun has the potential to overturn the results of the April 10 vote, this time in favor of Vice President Mohamed Ali Soule, the ruling party's candidate.
Well, the people already have, for the Aryan right, it will be a holiday, you know, because generally in Comoros, people vote on Sunday. The question is of the logistics. It's only 13 stations, you know, the two villages. So saying that, it can be a very simple thing, but are we sure whether everything really is ready? Nobody can say, you know. On the other hand, the contenders, none of them has raised questions about logistics. They only raise questions about how to secure the votes, you know, transparency.
The date May 11th was announced in a presidential decree. Why does the president have to make a decree? Where is the election commission?
Well, the decree, because part of it has to abide by the law, you know. This rerun comes not from the Electoral Commission, but from the Constitutional Court. And voting day has to be decided, at least promulgated by a presidential decree.
The outgoing president, it seems to me, what, is he in a hurry or does he want this election to be over with?
Well, in a hurry, here it is very well known that he is quite eager to terminate his mandate and go, you know. I mean, he has never been the kind of politician who stick to power. And he has done his best, you know, to hold elections in time. So it is known that Mr. Ikililu wants to go back to his farm.
Given that the April 10 rerun was very close between Mr. Assoumani and the vice president, the concern is that this rerun could overturn the results of April 10. What is the opposition saying about this?
So far, Mr. Assoumani says that he's confident and he accepted the rerun, but we have to secure as much as we can, you know, the transparency of the vote. Now, for the second round there, no, it was in the primary, if you could say. There was an agreement reached between the president and all candidates on how to secure fair elections. Now, from the government side, from Mr. Mohamed Ali Saleh's side, they say that this agreement has to be disregarded. It's no law, it's nothing. They have only to stick to the judgment of the Constitutional Court and the law, existing law. But no agreement, no consensus on how to secure re-elections. On the other hand, Mr. Assoumani say that they have to secure the elections as done before, and maybe with even more measures, you know, to be sure that the election is fair and transparent.
Mohamed Unchagama is president of the Consumer Society of the Comoros Islands. He was speaking with me from the capital, Moroni. 25 years after the world declared that freedom of information is a fundamental human right, journalists are under increasing threat of official censorship, harassment, imprisonment, and even assassination. Viewer Richard Green has more from Washington on the current state of freedom of the press on the annual observance of World Press Freedom Day yesterday, Tuesday.
In its annual report on media independence around the world, the human rights watchdog group Freedom House says press freedom has plunged to its lowest point in 12 years, listing political, criminal, and terrorist forces as behind the decline. Among the countries singled out in the Freedom House report is Egypt, which has been identified as one of nine countries with the largest decline in press freedoms in just 1 year. Egyptian journalist Khaled Dawood says President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's government believes the press should act as little more than a propaganda machine.
Our role is to provide objective and credible coverage of events that are taking place in Egypt, and the reality speaks for itself. It's not the media, it's not the journalists that create the reality. It's the wrong practices of the government, the wrong choices of the government that actually leads to the protests and the people. It's not the media. So even if you keep on conveying all sorts of propaganda throughout the media, that's not going to be the way to solve Egypt's economic or political problems.
Tom Malinowski, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, tells VOA that more than 70 journalists were killed around the world last year, while nearly 200 were imprisoned.
Where press freedom is denied, we are much more likely to see conflict and war. We're much more likely to see corruption. We're much more likely to see collapses in good governance.
The State Department is marking World Press Freedom Day by drawing attention to journalists previously identified as being persecuted because of their reporting and whose situations have not improved. Their cases are profiled on the website humanrights.gov and tweeted out under the hashtag #FreeThePress. Richard Green, VOA News, Washington.
South Sudan ranks 140th out of the 180 countries on the 2016 World Press Freedom Index. South Sudanese journalists working in the country is very challenging. For example, reporters say they have no access to information in government departments, and some journalists have been harassed and detained by people believed to be government security operatives. Wake Simon Wudu has more for VOA from the capital, Juba.
A group of traditional dancers performed at an event marking World Press Freedom Day in Juba. Journalists and others engaged in the media profession gathered to recognize the critical role reporters play in South Sudan and to shine a spotlight on the mistreatment of journalists. Philip Wani is a South Sudanese reporter with the United Nations Radio Miraya.
Sometimes you go to the field and you want to verify information, you go to the concerned or to the actualities where you can go and get ready information. But here, they don't give it to you. An official will not actually be transparent to you. He will require you to come with a written letter. You take it to his boss. And, you know, a lot of bureaucratic procedures, which is not good.
Wani says just last week when first Vice President Riek Machar arrived in Juba, some security operatives blocked some journalists from accessing the airport and the presidential palace, making it difficult to cover the story of Machar's arrival and subsequent swearing in. The Union of Journalists of South Sudan and the Association for Media Development in South Sudan are among the groups that organized today's event under the theme Access to Information and Fundamental Freedoms, This is Your Right. South Sudan's Union of Journalists chairman Oliver Modi says Government security agents continue to harass, detain, and arrest journalists. In the past year, 7 journalists were killed in South Sudan. Modi says no single suspect has been questioned in connection with any of the killings.
The challenges that are facing the media in the Republic of South Sudan, and particularly the journalists, is the recognition of the rights of the journalists to work in a free and fair environment.
Modi says government officials must abide by South Sudan's media laws when interacting with the journalists. In this year's World Press Freedom Index, as compiled by Reporters Without Borders, South Sudan dropped 15 positions to 140th out of 180 countries. Reporters Without Borders says the South Sudan government has restricted journalists from freely covering issues linked to the conflict. For VOA, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Today's Wednesday, May 4th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Seyoum Tiseheya is an Eritrean journalist who has been detained incommunicado for the last 14 years in Eritrea. He is the longest jail journalist in Africa, and his wife and two daughters, who now live in Paris, France, don't know his whereabouts from the day he was taken from his home by security forces without explanation. 19-year-old Vanessa Beher is the niece of Tiseheya. She has started a website, onedayseyoum.com, to raise awareness and campaign for his release. She spoke to Salim Solomon of VOA's Amharic service about the ordeal the family is going through.
I never met my uncle. He was in prison when I was 5 years old, but I heard about him from the point that I can remember, because my mom would tell me about all her relatives back in Eritrea, so I would have some kind of connection back to my country. And I was very aware of the fact that he was in prison for a cause that was just. So I was always, I looked up to him as a hero, like even when I was really young. He was a very determined person.
Yeah, and you know, right after he came, you know, right after independence, he was working at the Eritrean TV station. I think I saw an online interview with him a while back. What do your aunts or family members tell you about that? What was he like in terms of, you know, the days after independence? We could talk about before, what he did and how he documented the liberation struggle a little bit later as well.
He was very hopeful. He was a teacher during, also he was a war photographer, but also a teacher during the war of independence. And he spoke very much about, like all people did during the war, like about what was going to come afterwards. But he was very sure and determined that they were also going to have democracy. So it wasn't only freedom and independence, but it was also democracy and human rights. And after a while, he was actually imprisoned during the War of Independence because of this.
So you're saying he was imprisoned and then released?
Yeah, during the war. So like this was not when they were independent.
Mm-hmm.
For a whole year, he was imprisoned.
Did they say why they were imprisoning him then?
No, I mean, there was no trial because they were guerrilla. But he was held imprisoned. He even had a book that he wrote down his thoughts in, but they took away the book. And he said something like, they can take away my book, but they can't take away my thoughts.
Vanessa Berhard is the niece of jailed Eritrean journalist and prisoner of conscience, Seyoum Tiseheya. She spoke with Salim Solomon of VOA's Amharic service. Pirates have long prowled the waters of West Africa's Gulf of Guinea. A new report says regional navies have improved their ability to respond to high seas robberies, but pirates are changing tactics, abducting sailors and holding them for ransom. Christine tells us more from Lagos.
West Africa is home to the world's most dangerous waters. International Maritime Bureau statistics released last week show two of the three ship hijackings reported in the first quarter of 2016 globally happened in the Gulf of Guinea. 44 sailors have been kidnapped in the Gulf. While piracy is decreasing globally, the Maritime Bureau says it is increasing in West Africa. In its annual security report, anti-piracy group Oceans Beyond Piracy says pirates in the Gulf are increasingly taking hostages. The lead author of the report, Matthew Walje, says hostages are often taken to Nigeria's restive Niger Delta region and held there until ransom is paid. That is a change from years past, when pirates preferred to rob ships of their cargo and fuel. Walje says one reason for the shift is that taking cargo is time-consuming, and regional navies have improved their ability to respond to ship hijackings.
the time that it takes means that it's more likely to be interdicted, which then reduces the possibility of success.
Abducting sailors is faster and less risky.
It takes a little bit longer from start to finish, but the actual incident itself is shorter, and the likelihood of success is higher.
Hostage taking, however, involves more violence. Last year, 23 people were killed in incidences of piracy in the Gulf of Guinea. Walje acknowledged that regional navies are getting better at addressing piracy. He pointed to an incident from last February when the navies of Ghana, Togo, and Nigeria tracked a hijacked vessel off their coasts. The vessel was eventually stormed, and most of the sailors rescued by the Nigerian Navy.
The response is getting better, and this may be a temporary uptick.
Walje said a long-term solution to the issue would be for governments to do more to prosecute arrested pirates. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
The use of forced anal examinations to prove homosexuality in Kenya is being challenged in Mombasa's High Court. Human Rights Watch says the exams prove nothing and are antiquated and demeaning. Jill Craig reports from Nairobi.
Two Kenyan men alleged they were subjected to forced anal examinations at the Mombasa Coast Provincial General Hospital in February 2015, after police took them into custody for alleged homosexual conduct. They have filed a constitutional petition against the magistrate who ordered the exams, the hospital, the police, the Director of Public Prosecution, and the Health Ministry. Human Rights Watch senior researcher for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights is Neela Ghoshal.
This is the first time that we've documented the use of anal examinations in Kenya. And it's quite disturbing, I have to say, because Kenya has a reputation of having a quite liberal, cosmopolitan medical community, doctors who are very well educated, who understand what kind of procedures are scientific and what kind of procedures aren't.
The independent forensic expert group says these procedures are not scientific. It says forcibly conducted anal examinations are medically and scientifically worthless, and the practice constitutes cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment and possibly torture. Human Rights Watch says these examinations prove and accomplish nothing except humiliating those who are subjected to them. The group argues that Kenya's Sexual Offenses Act, as well as international law, dictate the exams constitute sexual assault and possibly rape if they involve any form of unwanted penetration. Requests for a response went unanswered from Kenya's Ministries of Health and Gender, the Office of the Director of Public Prosecution, Mombasa's Coast Provincial General Hospital, the police, and judiciary. Human Rights Watch says it has documented forced anal examinations since 2010 in Cameroon, Egypt, Lebanon, Tunisia, Turkmenistan, Uganda, Zambia, and Kenya. The Mombasa High Court is scheduled to hear the constitutional petition Wednesday. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Rebecca Ward has our next report, which looks at the impact of erosion on Senegal's beaches.
Beach resorts in Senegal are losing ground, and with it, tourist dollars. Government data suggests coastal erosion claims 1 to 2 centimeters every year, but not all of it can be pinned on climate change, according to Papa Goumba Lo, the head of Senegal's National Research Center.
It's also due to the fact that we generally poorly landscape coastlines, meaning improperly exported dunes, houses built where they shouldn't be or without meeting standards. So basically we can say it's the interaction between nature following its course and man who does not respect nature.
Beach lovers in the past flocked to the Senegalese coast in the hundreds of thousands, with tourism accounting for about 11% of its economy. But climate experts predict Senegal could lose as much as 86 centimeters of coast by the next century. Already, a resort town just 50 kilometers south of Dakar has lost 30 meters of beach in the past 5 years. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sports in here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with volleyball. The six-day Africa Men's Beach Volleyball Olympic qualifier gets underway in the Tunisian capital, Tunis, today, Wednesday. Gambia, Ivory Coast, Kenya, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and hosts Tunisia are in Group A. Group B features Angola, Burundi, Egypt, Ghana, Morocco, and Mozambique. Tournament winners qualify for Rio de Janeiro, while the silver and bronze medalists get another chance to qualify at an international tournament in July. Turning to football, Kenya's Ulinzi Stars have dedicated their winning of the Kenya Premier League Under-20 Championship to soldiers who have lost their lives while on national duty in Somalia. Ulinzi edged the Kakamega Homeboys 3-1 in a post-match penalty shootout after they were deadlocked at 1-1 at the end of open play in the tournament final. Ulinzi is the Kenya Army team, and one of their defenders, Kevin Ouma, is among those who perished in Somalia while on duty. On a more cheerful note, Senegal's Malang Diédhiou and Egyptian Gihed Grissa have been named referees for the men's Rio de Janeiro Olympic football contest, the FIFA Referees Committee revealed in Zurich, Switzerland. Senegalese Jibril Kamara and El Hadj Malik Samba, Moroccan Ridwan Achik, and Sudan's Walid Ahmed will be assistant referees. Meanwhile, Zambian Gladys Lengwe is the only African referee for the women's Olympic football contest. Malawi's Bernadette Quimbera and Morocco's Suad Ul Haj will serve as assistant referees. Finally, Ethiopia Football Federation and their national football team coach, Yohannes Sahle, have parted ways, the federation disclosed in the capital, Addis Ababa. According to the federation, the entire technical bench has been relieved of their duties owing to the team's poor results. Ethiopia needs to appoint a new coach ahead of their 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifier against Lesotho next month. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Monk. Have a very good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, May 4th.
Planned generation of 7,000 megawatts of power in 18 months. As disclosed in the local radio by Nigeria's Vice President Yemi Osinbajo, a welcome demonstration of good intention. It is also a dream that can be realized. I therefore like to call on the President Muhammadu Buhari administration not to rest on its oars in a bid to provide power energy to the Nigerian people. Thank you. Your loyal listener, Ambrose Ajio from Makurdi.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa News. The Kenyan Red Cross has located the father of a baby who was rescued from the rubble of a collapsed building on Tuesday, more than 3 days after the building came down. The father, Ratsam Sasi Wasike, identified the baby as 6-month-old Delayan Sasisi Wasike. The Red Cross reported the early morning rescue, saying the baby girl was taken to a Nairobi hospital with dehydration, but no sign of physical injuries. Rescuers have said there is little hope of finding anyone else alive in the ruins of the building in Nairobi's Haruma neighborhood. But the discovery of the baby has given hope to those awaiting word of their missing loved ones. And that's it for this Wednesday, May 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good day.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Next time on Straight Talk Africa.
We'll discuss Burundi's violence and security. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.